Accession number 9938, Reel 5.
Mr. Philpott, Reel 5?
Yep, and of course they asked the Germans who are pursuing the people who come out of this Luftwaffe tunnel, they asked for some of the clothing of the people who had escaped, and naturally they're given totally different clothing of totally different prisoners, so that their dogs could sniff it. And they were asked where the prisoners had gone, so the prisoners waved in totally different directions. It was a general chaos. But in the end, all of them were recaptured. There was one incident that we were told about at Doolegluft, that one chap had escaped, and they'd wanted to shoot him. And the indomitable wing commander, as he was there, HMA Day, D-A-Y, he was in command, and he said, well, we've been at talk about this man who'd scrambled out of Doolegluft, and you want to shoot. And why do you want to shoot him? He should be returned to the camp. And he said, well, he broke his parole, which he'd actually done, which is a stupid thing to do, and the wrong thing to do, really. And so Wing Commander Day, he told me about this afterwards, walked about the camp commandant with special permission outside the camp there, discussing this matter, and commandant said, well, Berlin are insisting on this, that he's got to be shot. Anyway, Day, and give a long story, talked him out of it, and he's thrown back in the camp. But that showed a sort of confusion of prisoner of war life. Then we were stirred up in Doolegluft and told we were going to Spangenberg, which is near Hesse in the west of Germany. And off we went with grisly warnings in the bus that anybody scrambling out of the bus would be shot instantly. And we got to Spangenberg, which is a village there, a village, and we marched through it and went into a camp by a little river there, a hutted camp in Spangenberg Lower Camp, and from which we were removed before long to Spangenberg Castle, which is like something out of Grimm's, stuck up high with great ramparts. And we marched through Spangenberg and decided to sing, which was considered by the men guarding us with their rifles and so on a very impertinent thing to do in a German town. And astounded inhabitants listening, British prisoners singing their way through Spangenberg. Anyway, when we were threatened with rifle butts and so on, we stopped the singing and entered Spangenberg. And it's abandon hope, all ye who enter here, you could say. Crash went the great doors. And we were there with the 51st Army Division, who had been captured, and a lot of whom had been captured there, and all sorts of people there, including Major General Fortune, the head of them. And he was the senior British officer for Army and for us. And we looked around for ways of escape. I booked myself up to go across on a sort of telephone line or an electric cable of some sort across the Great Moat with an Australian called Wood. You had a book and escape, so that you didn't try, you didn't have converging escapes and so on. And but before we could try this very dicey affair, which is very misjudged, really, we were then told, now you go to a camp which you will never escape from. It will not be possible. It is in Sargon, in the east of Berlin, and it's 102 miles southeast of Berlin. And we left Saigon in cattle trucks.
That's Spangenberg.
We left Spangenberg in cattle trucks, Spangenberg station, and we headed out to the east. We jerked around for a night and a day, and shunted into sidings and so on. I made an attempt to get out of this train, but I moved the wire with the assistance of others, and two of us are going to try and jump out, but it wasn't any good leaning out of this cattle truck and peering alongside, because the guard in the carriage ahead was leaning out of his window staring at me, and we knew it really wasn't on. Arrived in Saigon, which was in a flat place with pine trees. One always remembers the pine trees of Saigon. One got out, and we suddenly found ourselves not under the German army anymore, which mostly had their rifles at the shoulder. This is the Luftwaffe with Tommy guns, and Tommy guns at the ready, with this old gleam in their eye. And we were counted very carefully, and the German army was pretty sheepish to the Luftwaffe commanding officer of this little squad, we noticed, because he'd lost a prisoner, and Tommy Kalnan had got out during this endless journey in the night in some way I never quite discovered. But he'd been found wandering about the fields, and a Pole had given him away. Poles usually didn't, but under force majeure and Germans all round you, probably had no option. And so we were then told to march, and carrying our prisoners always look like a bunch of down-at-the-heel gypsies, and carrying our bundles and so on, and various boxes held by string and so on, and such possessions as we had, we approached the camp at Saigon. And the first thing I remember about it was a guard in one of these raised sentry boxes, apparently up in the trees. And we got closer and closer, and then we found he was in the 14-foot wire fence, which totally enclosed eight living block quarters, huts they were, in a more or less rectangular east compound of Saigon. And not only was there the 14-foot wire fence, but it had a jutting out bit at the top against anybody who might want to scramble up and over. And there's another 14-foot wire fence, 6 foot on the inside, with a coil of wire in between. And as we were led in the gate and shepherded in the gate, we examined this. There were no trees, no houses, no nothing, just these huts. And it looked a very rugged camp to get out of. And we were put into a hut and sorted ourselves out. And we had noticed coming in that there was a small trip barrier made of wood about 30 feet inside the wire fence there. And if ever, and we were soon to learn, that if ever you even put your foot on this, they were quite capable of putting down a bullet from one of the raised sentry boxes, which are there at intervals in this wire entanglement. And in each sentry box, of course, when night came, they had bright lights there shining down in the wire area. And they also had what amounted to swinging searchlights, well, like destroyer lights, I think, which the gods operated, and we examined the performance of these from our huts when we were locked in at night, and we managed to peek out a bit, although we meant to have the shutters up and you couldn't walk around at night. And we examined the performance of these searchlights, and we found that there was no patch in Stalag Luft 3 which wasn't lit by a searchlight in 20 seconds. Often they were lit in 10 seconds by this light. So the idea of crawling towards the wire at night was difficult. Nevertheless, Wing Commander Hull had tried it, while we were there. How he got there, I could never make out. But he made the mistake of going alone and snipping his way through the wire. He got caught up in the coil of wire, which I've described, and so he couldn't move, and he's trussed there like a chicken. And a guard coming off duty, fortunately, was not one of the excitable Nazi guards, he's an old chap, raised the alarm all right, but didn't shoot him, and he was taken away. And then of course, there was the question of jumping over the top. Could that be done? Well, it was extremely difficult because you'd have to do it in daytime. But in another camp, they had jumped from a jumping apparatus, gymnastic jumping apparatus, and a Frenchman had rushed down here and jumped right over wire, somewhat like our wire, so we were told, and made off. But of course, that type of escape wasn't much good, really, because the alarm was given immediately, and you couldn't take anything with you. And then, of course, there was the gate. Why not use the gate? After all, that's what gates are for. And we inquired about getting out of Stalag Luft 3 East compound by the gate. And they said, well, of course, Wing Commander Day went out dressed as a Hauptmann, as a captain, Luftwaffe, and received a deferential salute and steamed his way out, which is very good. But he had made his way quite deeply into that part of Germany, but his German wasn't very good, and he was recaptured and put back, and the gate defenses were strengthened. Another way was to merge yourself with something going out of the camp. For instance, Tony Barber, who later became Chancellor of the Exchequer, he went out in a laundry bag on the laundry van once, or tried to. They, unfortunately, instead of leaving the bag on top of the laundry van and moving away into Sagan, wherever the laundry van went to, they put it down just outside the wire for some reason. Nobody could make out why, and even Tony, with his determination, had to move sometime. He's actually cramped position, and guards can be dim, but they're not so dim that if a laundry bag moves, they get suspicious, and he was captured. And then, of course, there were the traditional stuff from tunnels. And there have been 60 or 70 tunnels dug in Stalag Luft 3, we were told, in the months previous to our arrival. But they'd all been captured because they all started under the huts. And the ferrets, who were security guards, whose job it was, they came into the camp in numbers of 0 to 9 at any one time. Their sole job was to prevent escape. And they just crawled around under the barrack blocks and with long iron rod things would prod down into the sand and soon find tunnels, and they did. There had been one tunnel, however. Best and Lamont had seized on something to do with the drainage being seen to at the camp, not too far from the wire, and a hole was left there, rather stupidly, at nightfall, and by devious means, they slid into this hole that was left for the drainage. It hadn't been completed, the workmen had gone away. And the word went round, they're in. And they dug towards the wire like mad things. And the sand was quite easy to remove with one's hands. And the leading one passed sand back. And the second one then pushed it back with his feet. And they moved along in a sort of moving cylinder. And they'd lay in that for hours and hours, but eventually came out on the freedom side and shot off without anybody seeing. And they made quite good progress, but for some reason they were boating down the Vistula, which struck me as an odd thing to do, but anyway, anything, you know, when necessity drives. And a large German soldier came by with a large rifle and pointed it at them, and their voyage ended. But nevertheless, this gave us the idea that that's the way to get out. Start your tunnel and start it near the wire and do that. And Michael Codner, who was an army man, who was put in with us for some inscrutable reasons, and Eric Williams, who was the navigator of a bomber who'd been shot down, and he's captain of that bomber, which is unusual, and was not greatly to his credit. They suddenly approached me on a hot day in 1943, and it could be very warm in the early summer in Stalaglav III in Sargon, and they said, come off that bunk, Ollie, come off that bunk, we're going to get out of here. So I said, I've heard that all the time, but I'm not terribly interested until, you know, the cool of the evening. Can't you go away? And they wouldn't go away. And they said, it's your duty. You're the escape officer of this hut, which is true. So I lurched off the bed, and we walked around the circuit, the inside of this barbed wire fence apparatus of Stalaglav III, East Compound, which I've described, lowering our voices as we went past the raised sentry boxes, because some of them could, the sentries can't understand English. Mike said, we're going to get out of here, and we want your help, we want the committee's help and everything. And I said, well, what's your scheme? And so Mike, barely stopped himself talking about it, he said, now, how did the ancients move people surreptitiously from one place to another? And I said, well, I don't know. I suppose you're talking about the Trojan horse, but that got a sort of mass of people, I don't know how many there were, soldiers, into a place from a great big thing as big as a hut or house or something. What's the relevance of that? He said, don't worry about the direction, he said. It's the principle, it's the principle. And he was a scholar of Exeter College, Oxford, and he was a pretty bright fellow. He said, concentrate on the principle. And then Williams chipped in and said, well, what Mike is going on about, he said, is that if we have a hollow wooden vaulting horse and put somebody who's going to escape in this, then we'll put it down close to the wire. He will dig underneath the horse and dig himself a tunnel like Besson Lamont did, and then cover over in the end. And in 24, 36 hours, he and possibly another two of us will escape. And I said, well, you know, yes, really. And they said, well, you're the escape officer. And I said, yes, all right, I'll take it to the committee this evening, the camp committee. And Wing Commander Kyle, who was in charge of all escape in the camp, heaved himself up. It was a hot day and a hot evening. On his elbow and said, "Oh yes." And the other members of the escape committee, two or three of them, said, "Well, what is this scheme?" And then somebody said, "It'll never come off. The goons aren't mad." They called the Germans goons. And Charlie Peltz, P-E-L-Z, the kingpin security chap there for the Germans, ferret. He wasn't born yesterday. He finds tunnels all the time. And then Wing Commander Kyle said, "Well, what goes on now? There's Tommy Callan who's digging. He seems to be digging in the wrong direction. What do you make out? He's digging another tunnel. And good luck to him, but we haven't heard too much about it. And what else?" And then somebody said, "Oh, yes, somebody's going out on the top of the laundry van, trying that one again, but never seemed to be going." And then Wing Commander said, "Well, there's not much going now, is there? There's got to be something. Tell these two jokers, we'll back them to the hilt." And the others nodded, and I reported back, which was rather a waste of time, because they were busy stealing woodwork to build the wooden horse, got their heads down and were quietly doing this, suggesting it was something to do with building of a bath hut and so on. And cut a long story short, from that moment onwards, they went on building this wooden horse. They did it very publicly, and Charlie, the chief ferret, went and patted it from time to time and said, "Ein guter Pferd," and they said, "Yes, Charlie, you must come and jump over it," and so on, you know, because the English were always considered mad. They played a form of rugby football in the summertime, and they played clock golf, nobody could understand that, and they ran round the circuit at odd times, and the English were always considered more or less mad on athletics, so that was played on a good deal. And tea chests were very useful. The side of chests that hold masses of tea, the three-ply sides, were most useful in building the sides of the horse. There had to be firm beams up and down the side and along the top. And along the top, we used some Turkish Red Cross parcel stuffing that gave a soft top to the top. And there were large beams which skewered in at the side, from each side, this side and that side, so that four people could lift the thing. And I remember when the horse went out the first time from a cookhouse, I had to walk down some steps, which were a little bit awkward, onto the flat sand and then up towards the wire, not too far from the wire, and was plonked down, and the beams were removed, and there was the horse ready for athletic jumping, and the most superb gymnastic display was laid on by prisoners, and people stood in their heads and went over backwards and went over forwards and jumped over sideways. It was really very convincing. And the German, of course, in their sentry boxes could be seen with their binoculars staring at this, dodging to the back and obviously phoning the commandanteur to say the English are up to something here, better come and have a look. And Charlie came round and announced that he'd seen the thing built, you know, and it's interesting seeing the jumping and so on, but he was nevertheless pretty suspicious. And then of course they did what was, you would say accidental. Some of the vaulters knocked the horse over, and Charlie nearly pounced and peered underneath it, and of course it's just sand. And he was satisfied as a result of that, that it was genuine gymnastics. The first person to go out in the horse was Michael Codner. It's the job getting into this thing. You put your bottom on one of the beams there, and above all, stopped dangling your feet down. You had to, the sides of your feet must be in the side there, and not dangle down. It's, the thing was built on the principle of a bell, you see, and you were trying not to fall out of the bell. And he was taken out, and he put down the other wire. Vaulting took place, and it was, as you would say, a normal session again. And he put down one side of a Red Cross box into the sand, and took 2.5 hours, I remember, and then covered it all over. And then he came in, and then he repeated that, and day after day, and. Then he announced, we've got a box down there, and I'm now taking the sand out of the box and putting some planks along the top. So I was duly impressed. And the job was to get rid of the sand, and I can't really go into all the things we did for getting rid of the sand, because he said any fool could build a tunnel. It takes a genius to get rid of the sand. Well, we weren't geniuses, but we really had to work very hard at it. We got prisoners to come in with hot water jugs, and then after the horse had been brought in with some sand and bags, with some hot water jugs, which they trustingly put in the kitchen hut part, and expected some hot water, which is always at a premium in a prison camp. And instead they got given a dollop of sand, saying, don't stare at it, take it away and put it in your little tomato garden you've got by your hut over there, and don't stare at it. And that didn't go very long. The German said, why are you wishing hot water in the afternoon like this? And then we did the potato thing. Two prisoners came along to this cookhouse, and where the horse operations were centered, and came away carrying stretcher-wise a large box with potatoes. You would say it was potatoes, a potato issue. And the Germans said again, what on earth is this potato issue? They looked at it and so on. They actually had a mass of sand in there. So that had its day. We actually then on a coolish day, actually it was a cool day or rainy day or something, and people wore large greatcoats, Polish greatcoats, which were very handy, and they went right down to the ankle and pretended it was cold, and it really was. And they were given, once the horse had come in with its load of sand from the bags hanging in it, they were given a sandbag under each armpit and told to take it away, get rid of it somewhere, get rid of it away from here, because tunnel sand was always a bright, well, not bright, but a yellow, fresh-looking color, which showed up like pieces of gold on the dry surface sand. It was always suspect. And as they walked down the little steps, they reeled about like penguins, because this was heavy and they weren't quite ready for it, and they made the most unconvincing display. And in the end, we put it away up in the roof of the cookhouse itself, in a cunning place among up there between two little partition things, which is hell to get at. But I used to pour sand in there, and it took a pleasing amount of sand. However, we tramped about up there so much that Aidan Crawley, who was a great man on security in the camp,